other folks like Frank, right? And other guys who have been in this for many years. I've been only recently working in this, I'm only a student and artist. So it's not different. My position is very different. Anyway, this group has unveiled for me many different things. One of those aspects are actually the alternative to housing, and also another important guide on this path has been Alan. I have to say that they have kind of been protecting the independence and sovereignty of the squatter movement for more than how many years, Frank?
We started squatting on the Lower East Side in 84, 85.
All right. And Alan, how long have you been in this?
Hello?
Yeah. since you were born, right?
No, really, I do some occupations in the past, but I have been researching the European movement since 2009, 2008.
Okay, great. And we also have Howard. How many years have you been involved with this?
I was involved in organizing homesteaders for 15 years.
So Howard has another kind of the same aim as I think the group, but has a different way of framing it and naming it, and I think that's also something important that you can bring up and maybe explain us in a couple of minutes. Actually, to be honest, and no offense to the panel, I thought this was going to be a younger panel, and it was actually more difficult to organize the young panel than to organize the people who
were before.
But it started out very well. I'm very happy with the whole group, and actually, well, I don't want to keep on. I could continue, and I really want to give the words to the group. So maybe we could start with Alan, since we could have technical problems. So, Alan, why don't you introduce yourself and tell us what you've been up to this couple of years, or this couple of months especially. You've been really busy visiting community centers in Europe, and maybe you could bring us what have been the highlights and the good aspects that you have found over there that we might not have here, or just share what your experience is.
Can you see anything?
We can totally see you guys. We see a couple of...
Okay. Yeah, I'm here with Eric and Beatrice and Olivier at the La General, which is the artist center. Began its life as an occupation in another part of the city, in Belgium, in 2005. Maybe Eric could tell you a little bit about the activities of Belgium in 2005.
Hello. Yes, there was a necessity in 2005 for a bunch of younger art students and people coming from the theater and political scene to have a space to produce, to gather, and so it happens in one of the most popular districts in Paris, 20th arrondissement, which is Fenville, which is the third Chinatown district in Paris. And then soon it was half of the street, a little street, but half of the street was an ancient school with a huge building, and there had been for 2 years many activities, concerts, exhibitions, and the machine was they were forced to dwell there. Because the people were very, very, very fresh, and they were in the heart of the life in Paris. So it was really dynamic. And after 2 years of quarantine, it turned to find another solution, because the building was belonging to the established to the Ministry of Education, and so we wanted it back to make a hospital, a state scientific hospital, which is now. So there was a kind of struggle to find another place, or rather two other places, because at the period of 2 years, there were two mainstream, one who was much more involved in political action, social action, and sheltering association, social and activist association, and magazine, and then the other part, which was as important as the first one, was the plastician, young people coming from recently from the school of art in Paris, mostly. And then
let me interrupt you for a second. Maybe you can tell us a little bit of what you heard about stories in New York, and if Alan, and between you and Alan, can give us a comparison of what's the scene like in Paris compared to New York, and what is maybe the legal aspects and the political aspects that might be different from these two important cities.
Why don't I step aside from that assignment, which would take the rest of your time, and just say that La Générale is not typical, but it is really an example cultural center that began in occupation, continued in occupation in a government building, and then when the building was in fact really needed for renovation, not just sitting empty, then they were relocated. Now they're have an artist center in the ceramic workshop, an old school again abandoned by empty buildings by the government, where they have a center. In most, I would say most major cities in the former West in Europe have an active occupation movement, active squatting movement that is seeking housing, but also seeking centers in the city where they can do political work, a lot with immigrants, and where they can do cultural work. The way that the General group was able to hold the Bellevue location mm-hmm. was through many people coming, making many actions, just keeping it really, really busy. That the people from the community were coming in and seeing and joining in and appreciating this suddenly cultural facility, this political center, which before there was not. The comparison with New York is that you guys are kind of in the deep freeze, I think, compared to most European cities. That's my frank opinion.
Thank you, Alan.
More further into it.
Yeah, no, you sorted out well. Actually, Alan was showing me yesterday where he is. It's a very nice space. It looks that we could send a couple of guys maybe from New York to there. And we have lots of artists that looking for a residence, and maybe, if they have their own garden, right? They grow their own food, etc. Kind of something that I saw yesterday. Am I right?
Well, not exactly. It's next to the nursery for Gastai, the garden the former king.
Okay.
For the giant tourist attraction of Gastai.
All right. Okay, thank you, Alan. So maybe we could move in and have Marta and tell us her experience and kind of holding to that idea of squatting. And is it another direct question? Is it disorganized or decentralized, the squatter movement? And maybe you can brief us a little bit on that.
Well, I can only tell you that from my own experience, right? I am not I was not born and raised here, so I came here when I was in my teens, late teens, and I joined one of the buildings in the late 80s, and it was an opportunity that I was not even aware.
Was it Umbrella House?
Yeah.
Okay.
Uh-huh. So, but it was like a salvation for me because I was struggling so hard. And I think this is what's happening right now. Now that the economy is so terrible, people are really having a hard time to meet their needs. And so this, you know, usually a struggle, a philosophy is kind of built on a struggle, I think. So by having the need, people here, and I think that's great. And I think that's what we had in the 80s, was a lot of people and a lot of buildings being exposed to the elements rather than being used for housing. And I think that's starting to happen again. So I think it's a great opportunity for the younger generation to use that opportunity and go for.
We were talking yesterday with Alan that there's always a time, right? And good times for this and not so good times. And maybe you were saying that this time is probably a good time to start getting...
I think so, because, you know, there's so many people being laid off and the economy is really crashing, you know. It's a lot of people are struggling. There's a lot of families become homeless. Not just the young people that want to pursue the political situation, but there's a real need for housing. And considering that housing is a right, not a privilege or a luxury, so.
Yeah, I agree, and it's definitely not discussable. It's a right, you know, like we all should have proper housing. So, maybe you could tell us a little bit about the diversity. I think that it's very important, something you mentioned, which is there's many aspects inside the squatter movement, right? And there's many people with different interests. There's some people who are more interested in the politics. There's some people who just need a home. There's also this thing, which is the stereotypes of the squatter, and I mean, I've been researching this, and I definitely think this is wrong, because most of the squatters I've met don't fit into these categories that they put them into. So Marta, which is a mom, right? Did you actually have your kid in your apartment?
Yeah, my son was born in my apartment, and I did not have many conditions for an apartment to have a baby, and other people also had a baby in my building,
mm-hmm.
So I was not the only person. Jane also had a baby in the building, and
she's actually here. Where's Jane?
Okay.
Jane's also here. She also they're both neighbors.
What I really appreciate from living in an occupied house is that when we were struggling and the building was dilapidated, was the moment when we really developed the most humanitarian approach towards your neighborhood, your community. And I think that's what made me really grow and appreciate a lot of the things that we take for granted on an everyday basis, such as flushing the toilet, you know, and the poop goes away. So that made me very, very in touch with my environment. And I think that created my awareness towards my environment and the things that surrounded me and my connection with everything. So it was that alone, those little things were a great lesson. I also experimented like a few things in Europe, But in Europe, fortunately, they have different conditions. They have a lot more to offer than we do have at in New York City. When we moved to our building, Umbrella House in New York, a lot of things were done purposely so people would not go there and take over this building, such as they filled the piping and the plumbing with concrete so you could not use, so you don't have access to these things. You know, the water, they made holes in the roof. So in that aspect, you have a lot more things on your side, because most of the buildings that are not being used are being warehoused for waiting for the economy to go up. So you probably, if you do anything like that, you don't have those kind of problems. Back then, they were trying to reconstruct the Lower East Side for what's happening right now. So, but what I wanted to say that I think was really important is, when we did not have water and we did not have plumbing, we were much stronger, I felt, as a community, because we worked together, we did things together, we looked out for one another. I didn't have a door or a lock in my door for until maybe 5 years ago, because I was not concerned that someone would come in and steal my things. And even though that happened, we knew and who the person was, because we were much in touch with one another. It wasn't like you walk in your building and you close the door and you turn on your computer and whatever. You have your this own individual life that doesn't really connect with your neighborhood or with your community. And I think that's really important, you know, because, yeah, I am older than you people, and I don't consider myself an old person. Hopefully one day, you know. But I think that we really need to create this awareness, because, you know, the world, who knows what's going to happen tomorrow. So it's not. I wouldn't say not in a anger, and not in, like, in this, you know, this, like, more is own your perspective, you know? Yeah, information is good. You gotta own your perspective, because I feel like just to own your perspective because I read or it's not enough, you know? You have to own your perspective, feeling like if I am here and if I feel this, there's reasons why I feel. You know, a lot of people, I feel, especially women in even in this progressive kind of community, I felt like they were not always heard, you know. They were like, you know, they were heard, but not really heard intensely. Before, when we lived before the doors, nowadays, I would like to correct myself on that. I think when we did not have the doors and we had to cook together, to feed everybody, you know, we had a common kitchen, we had a common shower, we didn't have toilets, so we didn't have a common toilet. So, you know, use your imagination to see how that happened. We had a piece bucket.
When did you get, for the first time, and heat into your apartment?
Well, I don't know. We had human heat, we had alcohol heat.
That's the best answer you can give to that.
But the central heating, the right kind of, you know, the heating that we're talking about, I think that was after my son was born. You know, my son was born without a general heating system. But we did have heating, you know, and a lot of people in the house.
That was 5 years ago.
Maybe 5 years ago, yeah. Right? So, and you've been living in Umbrella House, you're saying?
I've been living there since the spring of 89.
Okay, so maybe we can continue with Howard, right? And actually, we could say that Howard, he has built and sustained the Sixth Street Community Center, and I'm sure he's thinking right now that he wants me to say that it would have been impossible without the help of others, of course, but he has been behind this for many years. And maybe actually he could touch those aspects and differences about the challenges of establishing a community center, and tell us briefly what sparked the idea of creating this community center.
Yeah, actually I wanted to talk about the homesteading movement, squatter movement.
Okay.
We often use the words interchangeably. And the community center, I think, for me, grew out of that experience. But what Marta was saying about, I think, solidarity, social solidarity, is critical. You know, I think, if I can think of one word, that's the word that comes to mind. And there's a great saying in the article I passed out by this Nigerian chief: land belongs to a great family of people, some of whom are living, many of whom have died, and most of whom are yet unborn. So land ownership, land squatting, homesteading, whatever we choose to call it, is really about stewardship of land, not, in my mind, not ownership per se. And stewardship means we care for the land, not just for ourselves, not just for the people that we're in solidarity with today physically, but in almost a spiritual way, with the unborn, okay, the people perhaps we don't know in the community, those people who are in need, low, moderate income people, people that don't have the opportunity for one reason or another to squat with us or homestead, but also need that opportunity. So that's a huge struggle, that's a huge challenge in this kind of movement. I did want to talk about some of those challenges and principles for organizing, because, you know, land is in many ways fundamentally a conservative dynamic in capitalist society as well as other societies. People, when they own something, they grab onto it for dear life, okay? So we have to understand how to deal with that kind of need for security, because that's in many ways what it is. It grows out of fear, out of being left out in the cold. So we're going to hold on to our land. We're not going to share it with other people because we have to feed ourselves or we have to feed our family. How do we break out of that kind of narrow conception of land and talk about what I was saying earlier, stewardship? Unfortunately, homesteading doesn't have a great history in that regard. In the 1860s, just by way of history, the first Homestead Act was a means for the colonists, the white settlers, to grab the land from the Indians in places like Oklahoma and other areas that opened up in the West. And ironically, again, these same colonists found their land was snatched by land speculators, so many ended up with nothing. So that's a history in itself. In any case, we borrowed that word homesteading for this for our more recent, you know, endeavors in trying to reclaim a community that's been devastated by, I guess, landlordism and arson and all the ills of capitalist development and undevelopment. And I'm sure you've seen pictures. You know, I'll just pass this around, but you can see the kind of devastation in some of these pictures here.
And the conditions of the Lower East Side at that time, right?
Yeah, in the late 70s, early 80s.
Okay.
So I'll just, I was a homesteader myself. I actually live in a homestead building and I'm still struggling with many of the issues that I'm talking about today.
Very similar to the squatter, definitely, but...
Yeah, just technically, in the case of the homesteaders, we tended not to live in the buildings as we were renovating them. Our approach was to totally gut them out and then try to get support from anyone and anywhere, including the city, the state, the federal government. We weren't averse to taking
And who gave you that support, actually? Different.
I worked with the Catholic Church.
Right.
I worked with a number of organizations, but for about 8 years, the Archdiocese of New York, believe it or not, Catholic Charities, was a sponsor of many of our buildings. I worked with 17 buildings, and ultimately, 9 of those buildings became part of a community land trust that we organized because of some of these challenges that we're discussing today. As one solution, or one, I wouldn't say solution, or one approach to dealing with the contradictions and the tensions in trying to do different things. So our approach was to kind of frame these challenges in through three principles. Okay, so we said that a homesteading movement had to be empowering. That's pretty obvious. Everyone has to have an equal voice in decision making. But what's not obvious is how that degenerates over time into landlordism. For example, in my building, I struggled with the people living in my building for many years because they seemed reluctant to allow new people moving in to become members. They want to be landlords, even though we're collective landlords at this point, and the people moving in become tenants, so we end up in a two-class kind of system. And you see that in cooperatives, not just in the housing realm, but also in the economic realm, where businesses that start out cooperatively, over time, as people move out, the remaining members do not allow new people to share in the decision-making and membership. So that's kind of a tension that grows over time.
Right.
So it's important to physically feel the kind of solidarity that we need, you know, as human beings, but we also have to bring a certain intellectual intentionality to what we're doing, because we don't want to recreate the same conditions we're confronting today 10 and 20 years from now.
Maybe you could guide us a little bit on that and those challenges, you know, and the rewards of opening new spaces, you know, because you have not only done it as what you're saying with the homesteading, but also the community center, which actually there's only in the Lower East Side there's only two community centers, Sixth Street and ABC in Rio, which they all have a different agendas, to call it
right.
a way. But maybe you can tell us a little bit of those challenges and what sparked that idea of opening the community center.
Well, just to finish my thought, the other principle was that these buildings have to be socially integrated. And again, this requires intentionality in thinking, how are you going to reach out to different populations in need? Otherwise, you revert to a social Darwinist model, where those who are most resourceful become the ones who are predominantly living in these buildings and in control of these buildings. So you have to think about sometimes quotas, setting aside apartments. Well, I think you always have to think about that for people who may not be able to do sweat equity, which is one of the foundations of the movement, but not everybody can do physical labor. You have elderly people, disabled people, you have sometimes large families, just not unemployed. You have to struggle with that. There's no easy solution,
right.
But you do have to be intentional about doing that. And finally, the buildings, in my view, in order to sustain any movement, they have to be economically sustainable. And that's where we get into one of the most sensitive issues in this and challenges in building a movement of human beings in a not-for-profit way. And we have struggled with this issue to limit the equity, or in fact, eliminate equity in these developments, so that future generations will have the opportunity that we have had in moving into these same buildings. Because by equity, if people begin to value their apartment, and I draw a distinction between use value and transfer value. Use value is the value we get in actually living there, okay? In interacting with the people, enjoying our life in the building, paying lower rents generally. And transfer value is the value that we think in our heads, how much money are we going to make when we move out? You know, oh, I busted my ass to work here. You know, what about my, quote, investment? Look what Joe Blow next door is making on his condo. How come I can't do that? You know, that's been one of the major tensions in this particular housing movement, and I think as an anti-capitalist struggle, this kind of question is going to arise in many of these kind of homesteading squatting movements. So we took the position that the future generations have to have the opportunity, the same opportunity to move into these buildings that we had. There are different ways to have people participate because obviously they weren't there for 20 years of the struggle, but we have to create mechanisms to allow for that. One of the mechanisms was this community land trust, and I know time is limited, so I won't delve into that.
But that's a very interesting subject that I wish we could actually get into, the community, the land trust, because it's a... Can you briefly describe that, and maybe we can move to...
Well, land trust is a collect, means that the buildings are federated, that the land is held collectively by all the people who live in the squats or the homesteads in this particular community. And the buildings themselves, in the case of the Lower East Side, that we organized, were held cooperatively. So the land, by a common land ownership through a not-for-profit organization, we were able to bring in also a larger community voice, not just the residents who live there, but residents who may not, who don't live necessarily in these buildings, but represent a broader community and have some say-so, okay, in what kind of rules that are made with respect to issues like equity and resales, if you go down the route of resales at all, which, in fact, I think we should just cut out that whole notion of co-op, which today really means business partnership. We're not talking about the original anarchist notion of mutual aid and co-op today. We're really talking about, when they say that word, business. So that's the beauty of the land trust model. There are other models, social housing models as well, that should be explored.
I'm sure Howard could continue, and he could really show us another aspect of this movement. And I mean, we could really get it deep into conversation. We have had a long conversation about this, and I think in some near future we need to have this with a little bit more time, so you can explain us kind of those challenges and successes that you have had.
The community center, as I said, for me, grew out of this. We actually squatted this building, or it was squatted before I came on the scene in the late 70s. People had just, people on the block had taken over this abandoned synagogue and began offering social services to low-income people in the neighborhood. And I was involved with that as a volunteer for many years and became the director in the early 90s. But our task there was a little different. It was more direct service than this kind of self-help organizing. It was dealing with landlord problems, court, housing court, you know, Medicaid, you know, food stamps, all that stuff. We also ran programs for kids, summer camps, after school. So it was kind of a little different set of dynamics there. But our aim was to, which we were, I have to say we weren't really successful in, was bringing this land trust to include the community center. But the center is still there. We also have people who can probably talk about the gardening movement and how that plays into this whole notion of land and what I hope would be land stewardship.
Right, I agree that that's a huge other discussion, the community gardens that were taken there. And well, actually at the end they were taken back by the government, many of them, right? So, but we're going to kind of close that with that, and maybe we could have Frank respond to that and kind of tell us, you know, the challenges of opening new spaces and what have been the problems that we're facing today with that.
Okay, I'm going to be very brief because I don't want to run us too much time in that, and I want to have time for other people to, you know, conversation with the people who have came. Squatting for me can be defined as the unpermitted occupation, renovation, and defense of vacant spaces, whether they be condos, warehouse, public housing, six-story walk-ups, storefronts, vacant lots, unpermitted. Emphasis on unpermitted. In 1986, the city offered a request for proposals for legal homesteading, which is what we've been referring to here, and 12,000 separate applications were filed with the HPD, Housing Preservation and Development. Homesteading was legal. You could get a lease, a group could get a lease for a vacant building, you come in with an application for at this address, with a group of people, and you could get a lease to homestead that building through sweat equity, through work, work coming on the weekends, new work, and so forth and so on. And at the end of 3 years, you give them reports, et cetera, et cetera. You could assume title to that building as a group, right? Legal homesteading. It's called the Urban Homesteading Program, HPD, Maiden Lane. And a lot of the groups on the Lower East Side had that kind of support. I was actually involved in legal homesteading in the South Bronx in the late 70s. And we had, and so, and anyway, in 86, the city put an RFP out for people who were interested. They got 12,000 separate applications. That's 12,000 separate groups, 12,000 separate buildings. They took two, ended the program. So, in 1986, when we were occupying buildings on the Lower East Side, there was no legal way in which to do homesteading. So we were occupying, so squatting, the unpermitted occupation, renovation, and defense of places for people to live and to, you know, have community centers and what have you. I don't want to go too much into history, you know, there's a lot of that available. Urban Village, East Village is a good book. It's called Urban Village, East Village. I think it's Oxford University Press. Chapter 12. Andy, who wrote that chapter in that book, lived with us for 2 years. It's, I think, probably the most detailed history of the Lower East Side scene that I know of, other than Seth Tabachnyk's War of the Neighborhoods and Seth's work, which I'm sure some of you are familiar with, Seth Tabachnyk. Oh, here we go. Actually, we had this conversation about that graphic with Seth, and Seth and I were talking. This is recent. It was for Picture of the Homeless. We made it when we were occupying a Chase Bank-owned lot on East 115th Street. And I had this notion of the heart of the city. And I said, the homeless struggle, just a kind of an intuition. I'm not taking any real credit for it. You know, the thoughts come through you. But I happened to spit it out with Seth in the room. He said, yeah, the struggle, the home, it's like the heart of the city, the heart of the struggle, whatever. And Seth took that home and came back with Unlock. The heart of the city. This is like the genius of an artist. Came back with that graphic. Intense, right? I mean, it's Seth is something else. Anyway, so what I'm going to just close with is a couple things here. One, I want to give those of you who have pens my email, which is F as in Frank, R as in Red, and M as in Mary, FRM at Panics, PANIX.com. For those of you who wish to communicate on the subject of a current effort on the part of a group of people and a growing group of people to organize a citywide apparatus for mass occupations of vacant buildings. This is currently taking place now. History is important, but we have to learn from history in order to continue to struggle in the present. It's called 040, you know, big 04, number 40. With little squatter symbols in each of the O's, organizing for occupation. The idea is we want to create a citywide apparatus.
Right.
A lot of us here, and you know, maybe some of you as well, you break a chain, you go into a building, you know, and so forth. That's important to do. And it's, you know, it's highly desirable, and you know, from my perspective, it's the work of the angels, right? But on the other hand, we need to create a wide movement in this city. Women and children are the fastest leading demographic of homeless people in this city. Under Bloomberg's administration, homeless population has doubled. Right? There's a genocide going on, and it's called homelessness. The counterinsurgency against homeless people, against poor people.
Right.
The origins of homelessness have less to do with economics, has more to do with social control. I won't, you know, I've talked about this before, and I can talk more about it in
20 minutes. Yes, you can.
We need to deal with this whole issue of foreclosures and so forth. So, to this end, we've defined a number of task areas that would be necessary to fill in order to execute mass occupations around the city. So those of you who are interested in participating in organizing for occupation, please drop me a line.
Yeah.
I'll get you in touch with, I'll send you the stuff that we've thus far put together on this. It's pretty exciting. The last thing I'll say is that my sense of this need.
If I may interrupt you for a second. I'm going to pass actually this notebook, and if you guys want to, I'm helping Frank organizing this as well. So put your email and name and whatever information you want to share with us, actually tried to be a little bit more organized in my other gatherings, and I'll just pass it around and put your emails. Sorry, Frank, to interrupt you, but kind
of... No, that's okay.
Go ahead now.
Yeah, this is the current campaign, and it's pretty exciting. I know some of you in here are probably squatting now, or want to get to be squatting, or want to support the issue of squatting. That's what this is about. We're talking now. We're talking the zeitgeist is in our favor. Yeah. It's time to squat.
It's
and,
a good time.
We need to do it. This experience came out of working with Picture the Homeless. You know, when you're working among homeless people, your heart, like, is in a place where we need to deal with this, because the pain and the suffering is so overt. You spend time within that community of people that recognize what people are going through.
Yeah.
You know, but the discrete opening up of one particular building and working on, so as you know, for some who've done this, can occupy the bulk of your time. It's a big job to move into abandoned spaces and organize the group, and there's various components to it. I experienced that directly.
We got
a couple of buildings going and so forth, but I took a step back with some other people and just said, well, let's envision what it is that would be required citywide to do this. And that's what we've done.
Maybe.
So for those of you interested in participating in that kind of campaign, thinking through what it would call, we're not talking about an organization, we're talking about organizing as a verb. And we're talking about not as a coalition of housing organizations. Let's face it, most of the left, most of the housing organizations and homeless organizations in this city and around the country do not support squatting. They're sucked into the whole capitalist worship of private property and the whole thing. There's either opportunism, fatalism, antagonism, whatever kind of ism you want to talk about. Mm-hmm. They're not down with it. So we have to organize people from these various places as individuals within a network and a structure that can carry this out. And if you think about it, had experience, you know that everything from, we need construction people, we need people who want to work in the religious institutions, we need people who want to develop eviction watch networks for horizontal support, we need a crack team to go in. There's various things, legal. If you delineate it, there's a number of different task areas. We're filling those task areas now. We have a research team that has, with common law, which is a bunch of legal people, identifying the vacant venues, and we're looking at all potential venues. All right? So this is an ongoing process and a program right now that we're seeking to put together, so I invite your participation in it.
This is the era for an eviction watch list.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Developing the horizontal support. There's a number of aspects to it that are part of this, and we're talking about now.
Hmm. Well, thank you, Frank. And maybe you guys probably...
I think that's a great segue to hear Ryan talk about the projects he's involved with now.
Sure. Hi guys, I'm Ryan. I'm from upstate, Rochester, New York. I'm part of the movement called the Take Back the Land Movement. Take Back the Land Rochester is our organization. And we very explicitly try to put together the issue of people's need for housing with the political act of squatting, or as we call it, land and housing liberation. So, because everything we're doing is very explicitly political. So basically, our network is in about 11 cities across the country, Portland, Miami, Madison, Boston. And we're trying to create this as a social movement, a horizontal social movement where we network and we look at this massive housing crisis that is across the country, that every urban center basically playing itself out in basically the same way. And the way that the banks, who the most parasitic institutions, basically crashed the entire economy, and yet they got massive bailouts and really got the anger of everybody from that, from the Tea Party to the left, and everybody is just furious about what's going on. So what we're trying to do is to take an organized social movement. Our basic principles are housing is a human right, we want to elevate housing to a human right, and gain community control of the land and houses in a way that Howard's talking about of really promoting, changing fundamental relationships to land through community land trusts and other types of institutions where we can decommodify housing and land. And what we do is everything is through direct action. So one is through liberating vacant houses. So we identify vacant homes in Rochester where we have a huge homeless population. Upstate Rust Belt city that's been basically a permanent recession economy.
louder?
Yeah, a little bit louder. And why don't you tell us what you told me yesterday? Tell us a little bit of what's happening right now, especially with one case. We actually have a video which we can always share them online so I prefer if you can talk about it more than showing them the video, and we can actually show video some other time, I think.
Yes, so just briefly what we
and louder.
is that we move families into vacant homes, and we've only been around for about 8 months, but it's really generated quite a flurry. So we moved in 5 or 6 families into vacant homes. You know, we turn on the electricity, we turn on the heat, and basically meet the neighbors. Very like some people talk about backdoor squats and open front door squats, and it was very openly done in Rochester, and it's really been successful. Some people have been in their houses for the last 8 months consistently, and so this is, and we're trying to build a systematic movement in the way Frank's talking about in New York City, where we really build this network where people can plug into, and as we work is on the basis of needs, mostly homeless families, and move them into houses. Now the other aspect of what we do is eviction defenses and foreclosure defense, which is obviously a massive crisis. We have over 1 million foreclosures a year. Some people estimate just in the last 3 years, there's been over 10 million people displaced in the United States just due to foreclosure, which is more people that are displaced in traditional warfare. You think about the Iraq War and others. So we have really this protracted class war that's literally displacing people everywhere, poor people all across the country. So we want to cut off that right as it happens. So just in the last month, we've been working on a protracted struggle with foreclosure defense, where a family of 11 being evicted from their home by Fannie Mae, took it over from Bank of America, and 7 kids. Basically, the father, grandfather, and the husband of the family passed away from cancer, and then Bank of America refused to renegotiate the loan. Mm-hmm. And we got in contact with this family, and they said that they exhausted all their legal opportunities and channels, and they said they wanted to fight back. So basically, we organized an eviction watch in the way that Craig was talking about, mobilized the community. So when the marshal came to evict the family, he backed out. Then they came back the next day. We had another 50 people there, and they came with a moving truck, and the moving truck came, and they saw all these people there, and they just parked around the corner. And there was this standoff for about three hours. All the media was there with their big cameras. We go up to the moving truck and say, "Do you know anything about this eviction on 9 Raven?" And they said, "Oh, we're just here to meet a friend. So then they parked the truck up for a couple blocks over, and eventually they left. The media knew what was going on, they saw everything, and it held on. And we were actually successful in keeping the family in the home for about 2.5 weeks. We had a permanent eviction watch from 9 to 5 when eviction would be carried out in New York State. But eventually the city made a calculation. They said they really, really wanted to put their priorities to get this grant. At this point, a lot of people had already left the homeless shelters, and it's just a grandmother laying in their home. So we really want to get this grandmother out of their home. So last week, Monday morning, they sent basically at 9 a.m., like a drug raid, 20 police cars who stormed the house and to evict the family. And some people, fight back, because basically part of our blockade we had before, people were locked down with chains for the regular scheduled times, and they held on. So they knew that, we would put up resistance, but still, they said, this is really going to be a priority. So in response, we had 5 people and some neighbors who went and blocked the entrance, and who were arrested, and a total of 7 people were arrested that day. And what seemed to be, it was a gamble on their part, ended up being a backfire on the side of the police, because it really generated a lot of publicity. I just passed around an article from the Huffington Post that started to receive some national media attention. And basically, the next day, our congresspeople got involved, much to our surprise. The local congressperson and Chuck Schumer, the senator, they said, we're going to try to get this family back in their home. So the police, which, you know, Rochester, like all these budgets, have massive budget deficits, and they can't afford every time there's an eviction attack. They literally bankrupt the city if they sent 20 police out for every single eviction, right? And so basically the latest with that is, you know, we showed that it was successful. This is Catherine here, the grandmother fighting for a home, we showed it successful to stop the eviction. And here's
that's the action.
That's funny.
Very cool.
And basically the latest is that, you know, as of last week, Bank of America said they would draw up a new loan for the family. So this is a neighbor from across the street. She came out in her pajamas, and the police arrested her in her pajamas across the sidewalk. And basically, she wasn't even trying to do civil speech just because they're police, and they wanted so much control of the situation, and they lost control. But it really caused a lot of flurry. You can see all the police to get her out. So we think, you know, it's not over till it's over. We think that actually she'll be going back into her home soon, and we'll have to celebrate, you know, a pretty tangible victory to get these people back in their homes. So that's kind of what we're trying to do, is in a systematic way, and to move people into homes, and then also defend people who are being kicked out. This is kind of our basic piece there.
That might be a great point to open it up for questions. There's a lot of people here who probably have a lot of different interests in this, and we still have a half an hour left. So we've got our five panelists here over Skype.
So are we talking about squatting? Are we talking about squatting or reoccupying foreclosed homes here?
Yeah, we're talking about a range of different kinds of occupation tactics, from legal homesteading to reoccupying foreclosed homes to totally illegal squatting.
We actually have a question here. Yeah, go ahead.
So, up in the Bronx, there's an enormous amount of empty, vacant housing right now that's been now left for the city because of arrears and taxes. And this is the same thing that the landlords did back in the 70s. They couldn't make any money off the buildings, and they started burning them. This time, they just leave them to rot. And there's a lot of them. And these become, like, real urban problems because it attracts illicit activity, what they consider illicit activity. So with that said, if there's about a dozen buildings up in the Bronx that you know and that the 4-7 really isn't going to bother with a whole lot, how do you choose which building you're going to take? I mean, beyond just infrastructural considerations, like if the roof is there or not.
I will direct that question to Frank. He has been involved in that area.
Well, I mean, just very, very briefly, the various factors that would come into play. Physical condition of the building.
Right.
The owner. Is the owner vulnerable to political pressure on the street?
If there is no owner, if it's the city, it's been foreclosed on.
It's HPD. Mm-hmm. It's really a question of the structural integrity of the building. If the building is structurally happening and these are all city buildings?
Yeah, well, to all extent, the city may not have claimed a lot of them because HPD hasn't moved on.
Okay,
well, they're just in limbo.
Just generally, without belaboring the point, basically the research that's done on the potential squattable venue, whatever it is key. Early on, you want to know precisely the situation of that building before you have the crack, you know, an initial kind of crack team, what I'm calling crack team, go in
right
and scope it out.
Yeah.
So basically you do the research on the building and see, you know, is it structurally viable? In the early days, Martha can tell you and some of the other people that were around in those days, you know, you develop what were called squatter legs, so you could walk on joists and, you know, you come into buildings that are abandoned for a lot of years, the roof beam is in the front door. Hmm. You know, they're pretty fucked up. Hmm. So, but basically that's what it comes down to, the key thing being who's the owner, what's the situation with the owner, what are the potentials for pressuring the owner, as you know, that's the target. And then figuring out, you know, the ABCs in the immediate, which is a clandestine occupation. I mean, you know, because it's a kind of squatting which I don't, you know, call squatting, which is basically making a political statement.
Right.
You know, standing there with a bulk of, we are going to squat this unless you give us housing, that kind of thing. Yeah. No, covert, quiet, the whole thing, 30-day law, you know, I don't want to go into all the details,
right,
just
right.
getting some mail there and mm-hmm. so on. But, yeah, but basically doing the research on the building. If this is a string of city-owned buildings, I would say that people, we ought to be looking at those buildings. Because the city, for obvious reasons, is very, you know, targetable and vulnerable to, you know, mass occupations of those kinds of buildings. And those are the ones, all the buildings we took on the Lower East Side were city-owned.
Okay.
All right.
Maybe, can people scoot in towards the front just a little bit so people can get in the door? Is anyone still? I would just say I think that's a big difference between generally the kinds of vacant housing that's available today and what was available in the 70s and 80s is that the city's really trying now not to take possession of foreclosed homes. And so finding something that's actually owned by the city is much rarer. They tend to be sort of in that limbo and then get transferred immediately to different nonprofits. So that limbo stage, I think, is interesting.
Other questions?
Yeah, somebody wants to maybe ask him. The people in France, do you want to maybe bring out them? Yeah, they're there, right?
This is France Squatch.
Yeah, this.
That's cool. That's so cool.
The emails?
Yeah, yeah.
Especially in French, would be very good.
Wow. So somebody in wants to France. Bring another something up or?
Can I just say hi?
Yeah, you can say hi. Here.
Oh, yeah.
Alan, maybe you want to share something.
Oh, this is so cool.
What? Maybe you want to react to some of the discussions we've been having, or is there anything you want to add, or?
Yeah. The thing is, you know, this information has been blocked for so long. By the media, it's just, you know nothing, you absolutely know nothing. Yeah, this was almost a slogan of, you don't know anything. And it's really huge, you know, worldwide. There's a whole variety of cutting activities and occupations. It's about vacant property. The state, primarily the state, can't deliver the services it is in a way obligated for the common good to deliver, and they have empty services, empty spaces. People want to deliver these services, so they do it. You know, the question of housing and the question of political space for action, the question of cultural space for cultural action, they're all entangled. As the cities, you know, the laboring workers of the factory age, the Fordist industrial age, they're no longer required. They all have to leave the central city, which a lot of people can return. We know this historical dynamic of the late 20th century. It's accelerating into our own. There's a lot of space that they just can't figure out yet what to do with, or they don't have the means to do it. You can take it. It's just that simple.
Yes,
but you don't know that.
A quick comment.
We have no model, no example in the USA. The Puerto Rican occupation movement of the early and mid 1970s on the Lower East Side, which.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh. Okay, and maybe we'll have Frank respond to that.
Oh, what he's referring to is on the Lower East Side in the 70s, the Young Lords, and in East Harlem, Operation Move-In. There's a film out there somewhere called Operation Move-In, where the Young Lords occupied a number of buildings and a church and so forth. So, you know, the direct action for a home and for community space, you know, has been going on. And obviously, this in Portland, there's stuff happening there on the West Coast, Philadelphia, you know, there's a bunch of stuff happening. But what we should remember is that that movement is part of a global movement, which has there's some differences and so forth, but according to the UN Office for Human Settlements, UN Office for Human Settlements tracks you know, what do they call them? The unofficial, there's another word, informal settlements, so-called informal settlements around the world. They track squatting around the world, basically. The Office for Human Settlements. Three quarters, the greatest migration of human beings in the history of the planet over the last three decades has been from the country into the cities. People are migrating to the cities. No city in this world is meeting the housing needs of people. Nairobi, Lima, anywhere you go around the world, right? What do you have? Giant circles of squatters, right? All the people living in these all around the urban centers. Three quarters of the world's poor, as we speak, are living in houses they made themselves. Mm-hmm. All right? Three quarters of the world's poor. So the movement towards, you know, actualizing the human right to a home, which otherwise remains abstract, through squatting, is a global phenomenon. Right, it has different aspects. Here in New York City, which and the U.S., which is the capital of repression and pain and advanced, you know, technological military apparatus to keep us down, it's maybe a little more difficult. But nonetheless, no city in the world has the kind of shelter system and counterinsurgency directed against poor people, sophisticated in its depth of evil, that this country has. So, you know, we're up against some serious obstacles here in this particular place. But nonetheless, this is a worldwide phenomenon.
I just had a question regarding the laws. I don't know how the laws work over here. What's the law around squatting? Are you allowed to squat? Are you definitely not allowed to squat? Do they solve
very, very briefly, I once asked William Kunstler that, and Ron Kuby, who's since become famous on the radio, man. But there's no affirmative squatting law in this country. I mean, there's an adverse possession, which is rooted in common law. Right. You're in a place for 10 years, and actually 13th Street squats, and what Matt and Pete are going to talk about it. Pete Ken, you still went on Tuesday?
Monday.
Adverse possession. You're there for 10 years, and you can show that you've been open and notoriously there, and you have receipts to prove you've been there, blah, blah, blah. You can argue in a court that you take ownership through adverse possession, right? But under capitalism, there is no affirmative law to occupy private property. It's a contradiction to their whole shit, in their whole system. But on the legal front, there is a very thin legal maneuver that the Lower East Side Squad has made use of, and that's known as the 30-day law, right? And that's the only thing, that, you know, from a legal point of view, that we were able to maintain. But it came into play. What that says is that if you can show that you've been in a place for 30 days or more through the receipt of mail,
yeah,
right, then you're kicked over by the local cop on the block. What are you doing here? That, you know, you're not a trespasser, you're a resident. Mm-hmm. Once you move from trespasser status to resident status through, oh, look, we have, and this happened. You cops would come to the door, you know, these guys can tell you stories. I mean, they come to the door. Bureaucrat, we're from the city, you're in our building, you know, no, look, we have mail, and we've been here for a while. We'd actually send the city certified mail telling them that we were there, so that it would date the time we were there. So after 30 days, we could show, no, they knew we were there, and they didn't come, you see. So that 30-day law enabled us to get over that initial hump, moving from trespasser to then it's a due process case. Then they got to evict you legally. Not that stopped them from so-called self-help evictions through RoboCop, because we have some of that as well, as you know.
Yeah, Marta.
Is it still like that, though? Is that
the 30-day law. I was at a meeting the other day with some on another issue, and one of the people in the room was complaining about a roommate that had moved into their apartment and started getting mail, and then the relationship went sour, and the guy said, well, I can stay here now because I'm getting mail. And she said, yeah, you have to be aware of that because there's the 30-day law. And I said to her, oh, that's still going? And she said, oh, yeah, it's 30-day law. So, you know, it's whole idea of how do you prove residency to a cop? A guy comes, you come by, and you're there with a mask and a crowbar. And, you know what I mean? It's one thing, but if you can say, we used to open the door and show the ground floor apartment. We put a couch, a picture on the wall, show some mail, and say, see, look, we're living here. We've got mail, we live here. Get a public hall account from Con Ed. Establish residency through the receipt of mail over the first 30 days, and then continue. It can get you over that initial confrontation.
I think he can.
Yeah, we have a question. Sorry. Let him.
It doesn't matter if it's residential or an office space or.
That needs to be tested. Maybe somebody has some additional knowledge. As far as I know, that applies really anywhere. It's really.
Yeah.
Are you treated as a trespasser? You're there like a thief or whatever? Or do you actually reside in the place? City. And the local police, unless they're hierarchically, you know, these are hierarchical organizations, military police, they're given an order. And then they come with 150 of them, and they're going to come on you. But the local, no, they in their police regs, they actually differentiate between residents and trespassers. And it'll literally say, lives in an apartment, has a picture on the wall, and so forth. Okay.
Has anyone ever heard of nine-tenths law? Possession of nine-tenths of the law? That's often felt to be like, that's the squatter's rights law, whereby people, if they're in there, then they got a certain right, nine-tenths of the law. But actually, the origins of that in Anglo-Saxon housing law is so that the king would get his say. It's kind of a mechanism by where you
the
get
French.
Your day in court, but actually it's there because they don't want landlords taking self-help actions to evict you from a property in which the king is the sovereign
right. And
gets to say in court what's going on.
You have a question in there?
Yeah, this being an international movement, and I'm surprised to hear the information that you put out in terms of keeping track of these occupations. What would be the wisdom, in fact, what is the wisdom in publicizing these events so that different people can be aware and take part in this, or, in fact, would that endanger people in this movement?
I'm not sure.
This is like word of mouth. It's not like, it's not like there's a website people can go to and figure out when they can start squatting it, you know?
Not yet.
Right.
We used to put ads in the village board.
Really? Okay.
And it's soon to be, and actually I do agree that it's something that, well, there's a big issue with centralizing information, and actually, people are very sceptic to that idea of centralizing, but I believe that one of the ways that this could really help is actually centralizing information, you know, not ideas. I think it's a very diverse group, and if you start to centralize politically, you get into a huge, huge problem. But I think that just giving information out, you know, there's new media that could help us to just tweet something, you know, there's an empty building in the Bronx, you know, we need people to come in, you know, things like that. And that's something that I'm working with, and I'm working with actually with Frank about on this. And I believe it's something important, and it's something that it's very delicate for the same reason of centralizing information, which I think it's something that I don't want to open the discussion, but yeah, I think that's probably the way that we should go, is kind of have a place where we can all communicate. There's actually several of them, and actually I don't know if we have to open a new one or we have to work with the ones that are already there, which is something better, you know, like why opening a new community space or why opening a new network if we can work with what already is there, you know, that's also an important thing to bring. Yeah.
I have a legal question for both the French and for Frank. The French squatters. We've already taken one building, a group of friends and myself, and our problem isn't the police department, because in the Bronx, the 4-7 has bigger problems, like collecting money. It's true. Our issue is the fire department. Fire department's got a whole other scenario, okay? So if you don't have certified wiring, certified plumbing, the fire department's actually in charge of plumbing, we found out. Certified yada yada, you have to have certification that your fire escape is actually operational, believe it or not. If you get on the fire escape and the thing comes out and you fall, it can be like a problem.
Right.
My question is, are the coding scenarios in New York City and the coding scenarios in Europe squatting both kind of equivalent? What are your experiences in both areas with dealing with getting up to code and satisfying that?
Maybe, I'm sure Frank has a very good answer, because we've talked about this actions with the police, with the firemen. But maybe Alan, can you ask them over there How is the code in and how are the cops or the fire department involved in this in Europe?
Well, that's an extremely technical question. I think it bears more on Hausfrat, or visited in Berlin a couple of weeks ago, that are basically residential issues. They have contracts, cities are normalized, then they're required to do certain things. But generally speaking, in Europe, the buildings are in far better condition when they're taken than they are in the U.S. Or in New York. So this one that we are in, La Generale, it's an old school. People are technically not supposed to live here, so it's a working space, like a Soho loft in the 1970s. So these code issues are not up front as they are in residential buildings in New York.
Okay. Yeah, we have.
Beatrice has something to add.
I just have a question for folks in the room, I guess.
One second. Beatrice wants to add something. Give me a second, let's see. Hello, Beatrice. Louder, please. Get closer to your computer, please.
Maybe you were to describe about La Générale and what significance there for the squat culture. Is that I think functioning as a decentralized culture? It means that from the beginning, if we want to initiate projects and invite people and bring new things, that's why it was constructed here.
It's not. I'm sorry, but we cannot hear you, and unfortunately, we cannot.
No,
we cannot hear her, and actually, we have a couple of minutes, so we're gonna move forward. Alan, I'm sorry to not give you voice over there, but we're gonna play with the people who made it all the way here first. And
can I have a question?
Yeah.
Just one quick sentence to say that, which is that the fire department has been utilized in a kind of politicized way. We have various cases where you have a small fire in one of the buildings. Everybody's out of the building. They put the police barricades on there, put out the fire on a ground floor rear apartment, and then right behind the fireman leaving, SWAT comes in and we're not allowed back in the building. Or they'll punch a hole in the front of the building and run water through the front, and then the vacate order is they'll collapse ceilings in the front of the building when the fire was in the back and the rear. There's all kinds of bullshit that goes on there. But the technical point here is that is there a vacate order? In what way is the fire department trying to push you out of the building? It would be a vacate order. And if you can meet the requirements of the vacate order, which needs to be stated explicitly, and get an architect to say, no, this is bullshit. In other words, you gotta get their vacate order, get the particulars that are on that vacate order, do that work, correct it, and get your architect and your lawyer in there and so on. But bottom line is you got to reoccupy the place and create a fait accompli. We're back in here, but don't try to come with the bullshit vacate order because we've already taken care of those things.
Yeah.
And have them certified. We've already done that.
Yeah.
Maybe you want to say your name.
Sure. I'm Kevin. How's it going? I got here. I just want to say thanks, first off, for putting all this together. It's very much appreciated. I got here kind of late, so I don't know exactly what was discussed beforehand, but... And I will admit that I feel kind of silly. I was a bit apprehensive to even ask this question, but I think, in terms of just New York City squatting in the post-Giuliani era, and specifically during the 2000s, I was wondering, folks, squatting, especially people from New York, what is your take on, I know, a lot of people... for occupying the condos over by the East River, over in Williamsburg. I mean, all those buildings are just sitting there right now, but a lot of kids are all junked up, sitting in these buildings. I mean, obviously, they're not trying to establish a permanent residence. It's very much just having a roof over your head.
Mm-hmm.
But I was just curious what your take is and all that, coming from your perspective. Yeah, and I feel silly even bringing up these kids. I was just curious. Yeah.
Super good point.
In the squats, Todd?
Yeah, yeah, in the 2000s era, but in New York Matt, City, not squatting.
You want to answer that, Matt, for us, maybe?
It's a very unique.
Jane, it's like over the 20 years that people were squatting in 30, it diminished down to 12 buildings. The buildings that went down first were the ones that didn't have a community space for people, the core group people, to discuss issues like that. But when people first started squatting in New York, that was the main rule, it was no hard drugs.
Right, of course, but it goes on anyway.
Sure, but I mean, for those that are going to squat again in a collective sort of way.
You're going to see squat right now, there's people selling methadone pills.
Yeah, but they're established, and there's enough people in there that don't want that to get out of hand. Everybody... doing that.
But like, I see residents doing.
But that's part of the
guidelines, you know, for a core group of people that are going to take it seriously. Yeah, you can't go jump in.
And again,
you can't respond to
issues. And also, I mean, you know, volunteering in harm reduction circles and all that. I think I've known numerous people, you know, residents.
But not only in the squatter movement. I think the problem is not only in the squatter movement. And we have to really stop taking the idea of stereotyping, because I've really met a lot of people which are really aware of this.
Definitely.
And we're not into, you know, the heavy drugs, we may say. And that's a problem that it's not only in the squatter movement. No. It's a problem all in New York,
society
especially,
wide.
And all over. So we cannot frame
especially
that
the police department.
And
especially
yes.
Very much
so and that's part of what I've been doing, is actually finding out if that's true. And I haven't met that yet, you know. And yes, there's going to be... like anything in life.
But people only talk about, you know. Yeah.
So, yeah, part of this process is also demystifying that, you know. Mm-hmm. And here we have a couple of, like Jane, you know, or Martha, you know, and these guys, you know, they you know, they have been fighting for this, and they have been in the squatter movement, and, you know, they're probably... You know, the same thing as...
I think it's important to acknowledge that, you know, you're talking about a thing that's people moving into an empty or abandoned space.
Right.
So that's a spectrum. You can't really, like, there's not, like, a movement where it's like, oh, it always looks like this, or it usually looks like that.
Right.
You can have aspirations. Mm-hmm. You can have hopes. You can have gravity. There's certain kinds of things that work or don't work.
Right.
And part of that spectrum is people who have drug habits taking over abandoned spaces, and sometimes they're condos, and sometimes they're train tracks, and, you know, sometimes they're, you know, you go out to California, you know, there's people, like, living in tents on the side of the, you know, meth heads living in tents on the side of the, you know, and that's within the spectrum. They have a right to a dignified life if they're brave enough to go in and take a space. Great.
Same.
You know, and for other people who are going to be, you know, self-organized and, you know, try to govern a space as well together in a community, well, that's another thing within the spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it's a bad question.
No.
And I don't think there's any reason for people who are more organized to take a position against people who have drug habits going in and taking condo. That's fine.
Yes.
You know, it's cool.
I
take
agree.
The space, you know, whatever.
I'm
and
not.
We can talk about what works and doesn't work. And often, you know, it's hard for people who have, like, bad drug habits to govern themselves and create a community space and, you know, like, that kind of thing, you know? So that's a big challenge.
Can I respond to that, Martha?
Well, I just think that sometimes if they could become a burden more than part of the community, and I don't think it could only happen in a situation, you know? No, just... It's not good, you know? I feel like in my building... there was a lack of culture, of a cultural understanding, you know.
Because it was a very diverse group, I mean.
Yes, it was. There was a time we had a lot of people from Tent City. I don't know if you remember Tent City. People came from Philadelphia, and they squatted on Thompson Square for a long time. And they stayed, and, you know, they were great people, and somehow, because of that rule that we kind of have, they were, they end up leaving. And so, you know, I totally hear what Tom is a good point. But you do have to, whatever these people, whatever we do, we have to be responsible. And we kind of, to an extent, we have to share the perspective together
right.
and be responsible, own that responsibility together. And enough, so that's what is enough to be, you know.
Can I just say something for like 30 seconds? Yeah, I just wanted to say, you know, just generally I advocate, you know, anyone just, you know, I mean, people should have a roof over their head by any means necessary, in my opinion. And, you know, a lot of these people, yeah, you know, they have hearts and souls, and, you know, I mean, God, I know financial investors who are shooting, you know, pulling in six figures, you know, whatever. But I wanted to mention, though, I'm sure you folks are familiar with PM Press out in Oakland, Anarchist Collective. They put out this book recently called Tunnel People. It originally came out back in 96 by a guy in Amsterdam. But this is a translated version that just came out, and it's updated, and it's really fucking good. And it's, yeah, I can pass it around if anyone's interested.
I think we're out of time for questions, but if people have announcements they want to make, or also I just want to say to anyone who came in late that we have this book we passed around for people to give their email if they're interested in being part of an organized squatting network in New York City in a variety of different ways, or even more broadly. So if anyone still wants to sign this, we still have it.
Yeah, there's several events actually that are happening recently. It has been... Actually, we have tomorrow, there is a, what's it called, Squats and Condos, right? 2:30. And there's also something happening soon in the candy store, what you were mentioning,
with Matt,
right? You want to announce that?
Yeah, there's a discussion we're having
on Monday?
7:30 at Pete's Candy Store in Williamsburg on the Lower Mississippi stop. Me and Pete Spagnola, who was instrumental in the adverse possession case in 13th Street in 95, we're going to discuss Lower East Side squatting and talk about the archive. It's actually in Canada, too, which started in 2004, of the Lower East Side squatting history.
And the the condo thing is part of Trade School,
right.
And it's really just to get some other populations involved and educated about what's going on. That one's all filled up, but it's definitely just kind of keep people into a bigger movement.
And then I'm giving a talk at CUNY on Monday also in the afternoon about some of the legalities and the kinds of documentation people have to produce to make an adverse possession case, like what do you actually have to do to claim that you've had a property continuously for 10 years. I can send out all these announcements to the list of emails that people signed today. It's from 1:30 to 3.
Okay.
Where?
Graduate Center.
At the CUNY Graduate Center, room 9402. And that's more of an academic as opposed to a practical thing, but it'll have maybe some practical significance.
What time is that again?
1:30 to 3.
Actually, I'm doing also a more practical one, actually, and I haven't announced this to Jane, but I do documentaries, as I mentioned before, so, and I didn't want to spend the time showing you my project, so I'm going to do that the 28th of April. And that's going to be in Williamsburg, in Momenta Art, that's 359 Bedford Avenue. And I'm going to invite April and Jane, and maybe Martha also, it's more the woman, and because I've been kind of more involved with the men, and I want to kind of get to know more the, you know, not to separate it, but, you know, just to kind of bring the discussion up. And they have another perspective, which is much less political, and more of creating a nest and a home, you know, and growing. So it's all these aspects, I think, that combined make all this even a more interesting movement. And that's what I think it's my most important argument is the diversity and protecting that and through this. Yes, Frank?
Yeah, I'd like to just say that in our scene early on, as far as I can recollect, the women were the most political of the
what happened?
Group. And also the people that really kicked the work days into...
Right.
You know, really kicked it. But the other point that I wanted to make is that Matt made a reference to the Lower East Side Squatter Archive. I don't know if you caught that. There is a look, and they've worked on this, what, 10 years? A while, right? In this library.
It's very vast. There's lots
right?
of boxes.
Yeah, and we're here, so you should know. I don't know how you access it. You come in asking for the Lower East Side.
It's easy,
yeah. There's lots of boxes down.
Yeah, so there's a bunch of stuff here in terms of the history of the Lower East Side. So on the Lower East Side Squatter Archives is based in this library.
Yes.
So just so you know that for future reference.
You want to add something? Yep.
This is a larger statement to ongoing
situation that's not only in New York, but also developing in Europe. I think you're from Holland, is that right?
Yeah.
2013 is the 40th anniversary of Rauchport. And
of what?
Rauchport, which is, along with Christiania, the oldest squatted community in Europe. The two oldest squatted communities in Northern Europe, anyhow. They're proposing a series of convergences of squatters from European international squatters. They have a village 8 kilometers north of Amsterdam Central Station. They're proposing a series of convergences beginning this year, ending in 2013, to explore the state of squatting internationally right now. And they asked me to inform this group and also to be, work as a contact.
Is there any web page?
I'll work with Well, Rauchport has its own web page, but this is just in the discussion stage. They hope to have the first one at what used to be the Landgewelle, but is now been restricted by the state to the territory. It used to be 500 hectares. It's now restricted to the 80 hectares of the village. Still, there's plenty of room for a lot of people to get together and party and talk and be, you know, engage in this in a real way.
What country is this going to be in?
This is in Amsterdam. This is in
Holland.
Yeah.
R-U-I-G-O-O-R-D.
R-U-I-G-O-O-R-D.
Those conferences will be in August generally. That's generally when Landgewelle has. As I get more information, I'll try to get it to Alan. Certainly, Alan, you need to talk to Hans. I'll be emailing you, and Amy. I'll get it to you. And there's room enough for people to come and just throw down a sleeping bag or a tent and stay for the.
Is there going to be a meeting before going there? There's going to be like a New York chapter, or are you going to organize it?
No, I'm not thinking in those terms. I'm working with the Dutch and actually working on what's going on in Rauchport. But maybe, I mean, who knows? I mean, this year is going to be very uncertain, I think.
Okay.
From what I've seen so far. But, 2012 and 2013. 2013 is going to be 2012. Christiania is in crisis. There's the anti-squatting law in Holland. There are all these things that are playing out now.
Right.
And so it's time to start focusing on this again. And the communities that have been dealing with it for 40 years now, they have some solutions. They also have some sort of strategies for just interpersonal workings that are quite interesting and quite functional and can be helpful. They dealt with these drug problems in a lot of different ways and try to remove themselves from judgment as much as possible.
Right.
But there are all kinds of reasons. But I just wanted to bring the people in this room and the people on the Skype to an awareness of these convergences that I'm hopeful would be perhaps useful for many, many different kinds of groups.
Do we have someone? Is the panel, the next panel, ready?
I think we should close too, so people can get to their next.
Right. Or
I just have one last comment on that point there, which is the International Alliance of Inhabitants, which some of you may be familiar with. International Alliance of Inhabitants is a global network of squatter. Related organizations, and they sponsor zero eviction days around the world. They're based in Madrid, but they have and there's a North American sector being organized currently. So you might be interested in that. The International Alliance of Inhabitants.
Thank you. Thanks to all the panelists and to Sebastian for organizing.
Thank you. Thank you for coming.